You want to do a sound check?
You're all set.
You're all set. Okay.
Sets the levels automatically.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, well, so this actually will be a pretty cozy little presentation since we all know each other, at least thus far, for who's in the room. And Mockingbird, my student Michael, is here at my left, who you met last Yule. And essentially, I was going to do a originally going to revisit my PowerPoint presentation I've done for this kind of thing in the past, and then decided, it being the end of the day at a multi-day event, that to keep it a little bit more conversational and a little bit more free-form. And essentially, hitting some of the points I have in the past, along with maybe a couple of new observations on the relationship in Western mysticism and magic of the numbers 3 and 4. And I think this one part will be of a special interest to you, Mockingbird, as you had asked me some time ago exactly what diagrams and such I'd come across showing the correspondences of 4 that I have found. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. In a nutshell, the symbolism of 3 and 4 is extremely important to the organization that I head, which is the Order of Selahar, a mystic society of chivalry. And we are at once engaged in reviving and re-imbuing with meaning the chivalric virtues of the knightly age, finding relevance for them in the presence, as well as practicing various forms of hybridized Western mysticism. As we have gone on in our history, we have fallen more and more into using less of our rolled at home, if you will, form of this, and more looking at historic sources and tapping them. And I can think of no better way to express this than to talk about the meanings of the numbers 3 and 4 and how we in Selahar use them. 3, in a nutshell, is the number generally used in the West to express triplicities of internal correspondences. This is sort of a way to map the internal world, the world of the mind, the way we look at ourselves, and perhaps our interaction with other people. Whereas the number 4 has usually been applied to providing a framework for the outside, the external world. Now, I'm no Crowleyan by any means, but I have a great affinity for Crowley's sentiment that ritual is the act of combining the microcosm with the macrocosm. And certainly this is part and parcel of how we practice ritual in the Order of Selahar at its gatherings, which is to say we find ways to harmonize our internal world, symbolized by 3. Thank you for the water, Sir Robert. And with the external world, symbolized by 4. Now, when we look at the past and how these correspondences work, we can find them across a number of different ways of thinking. If we look at the symbolism of Christian mysticism, or even just exoteric Christianity for that matter, we find a very obvious correspondence of 3 in the 3 persons of the Christian Godhead, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Now, we could have a whole other presentation discussing whether the Holy Spirit is male, female, or neither, and that would be very interesting and certainly germane to a largely neo-pagan gathering such as this. But alas, there is no time. I will sum up. We can certainly see some aspects of perhaps a feminine counterpoint to the masculine power of God the Father, and certainly their offspring is God the Son. I would argue that Christ's gender is of tertiary importance at best. In any case, we find not a duality, but a triplicity. And this is part and parcel of how Western thought works, in that we really find the idea of black and white and no resolution between those opposites anathema. Our thinking is based on reconciling opposites, and hence we find the mechanism of thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Put more simply, an idea is expressed, someone expresses a counter to that idea. It is the synthesist's job to find some way of reconciling these seeming opposites. So here we find 3 in action right there in the dialectic process. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. We can see that when we posit the elements of the Christian Trinity and end up with the triplicity that comes out of that. We see this across the board. We can see this even in the medieval martial arts that my students and I study. Many of the ideas of how to control a fight are posited in terms of threes. I'll give a simple example that doesn't require anyone to really know anything about fighting per se. But the German masters that we work with speak about the idea of who controls a fight. If you are in control of the fight, perhaps you've thrown the first punch or the first cut with a sword or whatever weapon it is, if you've started something, you are acting in what those masters call the before. That is, you have acted before your opponent can act. Your opponent then must respond to this threat. He therefore acts in the after. He is moving after your initial attack. There's a third quantity, however, which doesn't even translate very well into English. It's a word the Germans use in the 15th century called Indes, I-N-D-E-S. And I really need a short paragraph to describe what that word means. Essentially, it means acting in the moment. So, if Rob here attacks me, I want to counterattack him in a way that it happens in the midst of his attack, before it can complete, in the middle of it, while it is still happening. And by doing so, I thereby regain control of the fight while also defending myself. So these three ideas that play off each other, before, after, and this idea of acting in the middle of an attack, all play upon each other. We don't have just who acted first, who acted second. There's this mitigating factor, this synthesis that comes out of those two ideas. So thinking in threes and using those to reconcile seeming contradictions is at the core of Western thought, whether you are a philosopher, a fighter, or a magician. We see threes in all kinds of places. We see them paired up in triads of symbolism. In the aforementioned fighting arts we study, we will often see we'll see three characters looking down on a successful fighter from heaven. It's not the Holy Trinity usually, incidentally. It's usually Mary, the Mother of God, the infant Christ, and the knightly patron himself, Saint George. So we see this element of three connecting the world of the spiritual, the religious world, with the very physical world of what these fighters are experiencing on the ground. Conversely, the number four we see used to describe the external world or how the spiritual world emanates into the physical world. Again, coming back to Christian mysticism and mythology and religious beliefs, we see the symbolism of four in the four evangelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And in fact, it's if you travel through Northern Europe, as I've had the pleasure and privilege of doing, and you visit enough old churches and burial sites, you'll find a lot of knightly effigies or even effigies of wealthy merchants. You'll see in the four corners of their funeral slab symbols of those four evangelists, the winged lion of St. Mark, the eagle of St. Luke, the bull of, let me make sure I don't mix these up now. I can't remember if it's Matthew or... And then an angelic figure is the fourth one. They usually mix those correspondences up, but that's okay. Apparently some of the medievals did too, because they're not always consistent. But we see that symbolism of these animal totems that are associated with these four disciples. And these are always tied to the four elements, the four bodily humors, the four temperaments of choleric, sanguine, melancholic, and phlegmatic, and of course the four elements of earth, air, fire, and water. We see these relationships connected to a whole medieval cosmology of emanation of heavenly power through the planets, through the spheres of the four elements surrounding the earth that we live upon. So the physical world is couched on this. And we can go on and on and on about correspondences of four. Four winds. Again, the four evangelists, evangelistic animal totems, the four elements, the four humors, the four seasons, the four cardinal points of the compass. All these things have correspondences that can be traced. More importantly, and where I am kind of picking up from last year's lecture, where I used the PowerPoint presentation to show these correspondences ad nauseum, perhaps, is to talk a little bit about how we use these sets of correspondences in our ritual that we use in the Order of Szilahar, the knightly and mystic society that the three of us actually here all hail from. As I said very early on, and I'm not sure you were in the room yet at this point, but there's an idea expressed certainly by Crowley, but certainly by others, of uniting the microcosm and the macrocosm in unity to do magic. And when we cast a circle in Szilahar ritual, it is exactly that that we are doing. Mockingbird, although he can't see me wearing it right now, knows I'm wearing a badge with the emblem of the Triquetra, which is the pattern of three knotwork I'm wearing on my breast. That's the emblem of our order. But it's also symbolic of a lot of things. Certainly the internal correspondences of three we've talked about. We could add mind, body, and spirit to that, incidentally, in a perhaps a slightly more hokey way. What we do and where we use the symbolism of this sigil is when we invoke the elements at the four quarters, we are either with a sword or dagger in hand or whatever, or just the empty hand, tracing this symbol in the air at each of the four quarters. Now, the idea of doing that is to make a connection between our internal world, symbolized by three, with the external physical world, symbolized by four. So from the very get-go, in one of our rites, we are making that connection. At the end of ritual, when we bid the elemental powers to depart, we are reversing that process and bidding them hail and farewell, tracing the triquetra usually in the opposite direction, counterclockwise instead of clockwise. Now, in addition to being an emblem that inherently has symbolism of three in it, there's also another rather nice thing that comes out of it. As I said before, three is a way to reconcile seeming dualities and contradictions. Well, male and female is certainly one of those obvious dualities for human beings and for most animals. In many ways, the triquetra as an emblem inherently does that. If you think about it, it's sort of what happens when you hybridize a circle with a triangle. And triangles and circles are found as symbolisms of masculinity and femininity. In fact, if you travel around Europe, you'll find sometimes that's all you know to go to the right bathroom, is whether you see one of those shapes, which I'm sure can be a little confusing to the less mystically inclined foreigners among us, but made sense to me. So the triquetra really marries, and marry is the right word, marries those two dualities together just by the sake of forming that shape. It is at once a circle in that it is an unbroken loop that you can keep moving through, but it's also triangular. So it's got both those things put together. It synthesizes those dualities. And that's no accident. So we are using the symbol of the triquetra to invoke the elements. But in doing so, we are not treating them simply as outside forces. We are bringing them within the circle and uniting them with our internal selves. Now, I'll talk a little bit more about three and what it means to the Order of Szilahar and some of the symbolism it is tied in with what we do. As a knightly fellowship in the modern age, practicing various forms of magic, we, of course, draw from a lot of medieval lore and certainly a lot of medieval romance, and particularly the knightly romances, the Arthurian cycle, the matter of the Grail, all this legendary we tap into. With that in mind, the three elements of our regalia, and perhaps I should have brought some representations thereof today, footnote for next time, are the sword, the crown, and the Grail. And those line up on the points of the triquetra because of what they symbolize magically. The sword, obviously enough, is a masculine element. It's semi-phallic in nature. It has, obviously, an aggressive, active quality to it. The Grail is receptive, womb-like, introspective. Right there, we see that duality of masculine and feminine forces at play. The crown is the unifying principle. It is sort of the crowned philosopher reconciling these dualities. So, Again, we have started our ritual by invoking the four elements, doing so with the symbolism of three. Our ritual then proceeds on to invoke deity names that I'm not even going to bother mentioning here because they are ones we made up for our own use. And each of those is tied to one of these elements of the regalia. So that element of the regalia is picked up by the celebrant who is doing the invocation for that particular god form. And they speak their part and then place that piece of the regalia back down. So we've drawn in external forces, symbolized by four, invoked these god forms, which really represent things that are in us. These are internal things. We're not imagining drawing them out from another dimension or from the void or from heaven or up from the earth. We're really calling them from within, connecting ourselves and our symbolic selves to the symbolism of nature that we see symbolized by four. At this point, we have all these forces in play, and this is where perhaps the holiest part of Silahar ritual occurs. And I spoke before about the grail being the introspective portion of our regalia. It is also the experiential part. It represents our shared vision. So the grail is shared, passed around by one of the celebrants to everyone standing in the circle. After that, we will share in spirit and energy. And then we basically put things back where they came from. We bid farewell to the powers of three, bid farewell to the elemental powers. So everything is built up, and then everything is taken back down to return to normal reality again, as it were. Now, this is not tremendously unique. You can find elements of this kind of practice in many traditions. Why I think it's important to talk about what we do specifically is I sometimes worry that some modern magic traditions worry a little bit too much about two and forget about that synthesis portion that is inherent in Western thinking. We talk about the god and the goddess a lot, but we don't necessarily talk enough about what comes out of that union. And that product of that union is just as important, if not more so, than its parents. It's the future. We could look at those triplicities as past, present, and future if we wanted to. So where is the future? The future is in reconciling and harmonizing. Harmonizing is really the right word, and synthesizing what comes out of those dualities. And that was really what I wanted to have folks take home the most about this, is to think about how they might incorporate that sort of idea in whatever practice they do magically, the idea of looking for the three instead of the two, and seeing how to harmonize that three, that whole human being that reconciles conflict, reconciles dualities, and is whole with three. Yes, Mockingbird?
Another way for the triplicity to be expressed, which goes along with the sword and the grail, and is used in other traditions, the sun, that is S-O-N, not S-U-N. Mm-hmm. S-U-N is what I'm looking for, is associated with matter, the goddess with space, thus the receptive thing, and the dragon with time.
Mm-hmm.
So those are three important elements, both of the external and the internal world.
Oh yeah, there's a million ways to approach this. I'm explaining simply but what our current tradition does. And I'll also say that we have not had this as finely honed as we have now. This really much more in-depth understanding of this is probably 4 years old. So this is like any magic tradition, it's a work in progress. But yes, that's another way of looking at that, and there's probably a half dozen others.
The time, therefore, is very much just, as you're saying, associated mostly with the future.
Mm-hmm.
It takes time to get that sentence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I came across yet another way of looking at some of these things. That revelation about, I always knew the triquetra was a circle and a triangle. How important that was and why is something from literally last week. That is a last week thing. So that's, hot off the presses, if you will. and that's a good way to explain its symbolism as well. But now, onto the new bit of research that I promised you, Mockingbird, which was something that I had stumbled across a long time ago. You and I have had much discussion about which cardinal point is which element and all that, and you very correctly challenged me, well, where did you get that from, young feller? Not quite in that language, but... I struggled for months because I knew I had seen it somewhere, laid out exactly as we used it, and then I finally re-stumbled upon it. It comes from Isidore of Seville. There is a 9th century diagram that lays it out exactly the way I described it to you when we had the PowerPoint presentation that I talked to you through. So I actually did find the smoking gun on that. I had it in my files somewhere. It just took a lot of rummaging through them again to have a re-aha moment, shall we say, because I was starting to think I had gone crazy. Wait a minute, maybe I did just make this up. So, no, it is out there. What we're actually talking about is we use a correspondence of the four elements quite different than most modern practitioners, and different again from the system that Mockingbird is generally used.
But it's just a mirror image of mine.
That's right. That's right. But he's got actually, even the seasons, directions, elements, humors, all laid out pretty much the way we're using. So that's not to say it's the only way to do it. Of course, it isn't. You can find all kinds of other stuff. But so yes, I was hard pressed to completely justify exactly where ours had come from. But essentially, what is different is the order that we are assigning the cardinal points with the elements is in the order that they are reckoned to emanate by the classic philosophers, which is to say, from heavenward down, it's fire, air, water, and earth. And the reasons for that are the ways that the elements are described, because they each have a quality, or two qualities to them. Fire is reckoned to be hot and dry. Air is reckoned to be hot and wet, water to be cold and wet, and finally earth, cold and dry. So you can see as you go down, one of those qualities, only one changes at a time, so it kind of dominoes its way down.
It also goes into the circle.
And you can arrange it in a circular fashion. If you loop back around, earth back up to fire, the dry part stays the same, but now it's hot and dry again instead of cold and dry. So if you lay this out circularly on the compass, the way most Wiccans use it, they've actually got water and earth flipped around. And that bugged me for years, and I didn't know why it bugged me. And then when I learned more about the qualities of the elements, it was, okay, this is why this has been driving me a little crazy.
It's not a progression of energy either.
Right.
Not changing through the states of matter.
Right. Yes, this is the other wonderful thing about the elements. So people too guilty of, let us say, not scientific but scientistic thinking today find it very easy to look at, well, back then they thought there were four elements and we know there's 113 plus or minus whatever. What they're misunderstanding is that the ancients meant something different by element than we mean today. What the ancients were absolutely correct about, even before modern scientists were the four states, the four usual states, let me say, of matter. Earth is solid. Water is liquid. Air is gas. Fire is plasma. Those are the four states of matter we normally can experience. Now, particle physicians will tell you about, physicists will tell you about all kinds of crazy states of matter that you have to have very expensive equipment to even discern, but that's not part of our experience of the physical world with our senses. But here the ancients figured this out, and we modern people are sometimes blind to this because we're too hung up on the word element and not realizing that it is a way of describing the status of the elements. And they knew very well that copper was separate from iron and separate from sulfur. They knew about some of the elements we know about. They just used a different word for them. So sometimes our language or languages can get us not seeing the forest for the trees.
Besides, most of the elements in the periodic table are merit badges for scientists because you need certain conditions to put that single electron into the atom?
Well, the higher elements of the periodic table exist for nanoseconds.
Yeah.
Element number 113 can only be recreated in a particle accelerator using the amount of power that a small South American country uses. So, yeah, that's not something you're going to stumble onto. Einsteinium, I knew it! You're not going to kick a stone of that around in the woods. So, no, the more prosaic elements are the ones that we're more used to seeing. When we look at the system of the four elements and look at all these connections, these quadruplicities, these connections of four, the ancients had a simple framework model for understanding their universe. And for as much of it as they needed to understand, it was a system in perfection. It described everything they needed to know at that time. It's not enough to describe our modern world, where we need to worry about exactly which rare metal that only the Chinese are able to get we need for our cell phones. But it was good enough for a farming calendar, a simple economic system, marking the progress of the stars and planets. Their understanding suited them. It's too easy for us modern people to scoff at them when, in fact, they had everything they needed. So, indeed, this is a very resonant system. Now, I promised in the title of this that I would touch on the number 7, which is what happens, of course, when you add 3 plus 4. And this is very significant when we look at learning in the Middle Ages and the entire curriculum of knowledge. I'm going to describe in brief the medieval university system and what you learned. You needed to learn 3 before you could learn 4. Now let me rephrase that. You need to understand yourself before you can understand the world. Now I'll be less obtuse and spell this out. The curriculum of 3 is what the classical thinkers called the trivium, and this was inherited by our medieval forebears in Europe. And the trivium is the studies of the disciplines of grammar, rhetoric, and logic. Essentially, it's the study of how to resolve contradictions and problems. It's the way of expressing yourself. It's the way of being able to read and write effectively. How can you know yourself if you don't know how to interact with other people? How can you learn about yourself without having others help you learn about yourself? How can you do any of those things without the tools of communication, debate, and understanding? Grammar, rhetoric, and logic. Now, these are much broader ideas than what we mean by grammar in elementary school today. Mockingbird, please.
Yeah, I've always thought it was grammar, rhetoric, and dialectic, which works better when you consider that you're looking for the synthesis, and dialectic is always concerned with synthesis.
Yes, and we are both right, because in fact, when we look at the terminology used, those two terms are used more generally and interchangeably.
But they aren't actually interchangeable philosophically.
Today, maybe not. In the blurry curriculum of the trivium, yes. And so depending on which manuscript you look at, you'll see one term or the other. And the author is not talking about separate things. Much in the way that we have a very specific meaning when we discuss learning grammar today, but that is a far broader topic in the Middle Ages.
And similarly, when they said dialectic, they did not mean Hegelian or Marxist.
Exactly. They mean something a little different right there.
Yeah.
But in any case, specifics aside, these are internal disciplines. These are things that you need to learn to be a successful, smart, interactive human that is capable of expressing his ideas and learning them from others. That's the trivium, and that means really the three ways, the three paths. And until you've mastered the trivium, you are not fit to learn the quadrivium, which is the study of the external world. And the quadrivium is arithmetic, geometry, music, don't look confused yet, I'll explain, and astronomy. That sounds like a weird combo, doesn't it? All right, well, let me explain.
What order that you're doing?
Oh, no.
You're doing a cross rather than around.
Yes. A cross may be slightly up, as I will make clear.
Yeah.
They all involve the study of number. Arithmetic is the study of pure number. Geometry is the study of number in space. Music, notes separated by silences, is the study of number in time. And astronomy, the music of the spheres, is the study of number in time and space. So there's a progression there. Now, this is obviously a very broad, generalized way of talking about the natural sciences. And who would have thought of, you know, music as a science? Well, it's an art. Well, the ancients didn't quite think that way. Music, there was a science to music. And if you corner someone like the pianist Alfred Brendel and bend his ear, and by the way, he's an extremely mystically inclined gentleman, as I found out to my great joy, he would completely nod in agreement that, oh yes, it is indeed a science.
And astronomy was concerned with the music of the spheres.
Music of the spheres, exactly. So we see this progression of the study of number. The trivium is the study of the internal world. The quadrivium is the study of the external world. And until you've mastered all seven of those, the seven liberal arts, you are completely unfit to study the highest forms of learning, which are philosophy itself and sacred theology. There's a wonderful drawing that from a 15th century manuscript that I really should have brought with me. And it shows... It shows this diagram of three noble ladies leading the four wheels of a cart representing the quadrivium, which is being pulled by a harness pulled by three other ladies representing the trivium, and sacred theology is being carried in the cart, and a philosopher is using a lash to speed them on forward. So it's sort of connecting with this crazy diagram, all these ideas put together. So you are not fit to study those really advanced studies, philosophy, theology, until you had had the basics. Sound like a lot of pretty heavy-duty basics, don't they? But this is the medieval curriculum. Know yourself. Oh, I still have a little bit left, thank you. Know yourself, know the world, before you can try to know philosophy or know God. So we have this symbolism of three plus 4 equals 7. Now, this symbolism of 7, combining the 3 and the 4, goes on even further. The understanding of the cosmos at the time recognized 7 planets. Who knows what those are? Mockingbird, you don't get to answer. Who wants to take a crack at it? You already know.
Okay. Well, I mean, I guess it's depending, like, if it's like a geocentric or a heliocentric.
Definitely geocentric, I'll give you that.
Okay, figured. Well, in that case, we would have Mercury, Venus, the Sun, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn.
Did you say the moon?
I didn't say the moon, but I was forgetting one of them.
Yep, that's the moon, yep.
That was the closest.
That would be the first one.
Yes,
So we have the 7 planets. There is a whole system of planetary astrology. In fact, one of the things that runs concurrent with the manuscripts on fighting that I researched from southern Germany from the 15th century is this whole lore called the Planetenkinder, which means the children of the planets. And you'll find these delightful montages showing the planet riding a chariot across the sky, and then the types of people associated with that planet's influence, doing their various activities, some noble, some nefarious, on the earth below. And we see this symbolism repeated over and over. The aforementioned crazy drawing I talked about with the chariot and the lash and sacred geometry and the 7 liberal arts, before we get to that culminating drawing, we have a series of drawings showing the symbolism of the 7 planets, showing their connection to the canonical hours of the day, the 7 ages of man, some correspondences with the zodiac. You may imagine that there's a little bit of fudging, since 12 zodiacal signs does not neatly divide into 7 planets. So a little fudging is done, shall we say. And then we see the connections of those planets, which of the 7 liberal arts they are associated with. So we're seeing this entire cosmology that shows the arrangement of the heavens, the emanation through the 4 elements, the influence of the heavens upon humans, not just their dispositions, but their studies and how those should be conducted. This is a very holistic system. And rife with potential symbolism to tap for ritual. And one of my things I'm going to sort of say before turning the floor over to discussion is, this is sort of my mission as a mystic in the 21st century, is unearthing some of these tools so people realize that, yes, we came up with a lot of really cool New Age stuff to play with in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, but maybe it's time to go back and look at some of the things, symbolism, our ancestors knew for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and mine those traditions again and see what we can do to play with them. And from our own experimentation back home and the ritual we do, I can tell you it is a toolbox that is bottomless. There is an infinity of good stuff to play with, to use in ceremony, for meditation, for personal study, even for crafting one's own body and how to use it. We use this symbolism in the fighting stuff we work with because it is tied into it. Because the medieval worldview on how their fighting systems were structured was informed by this holistic thinking, and vice versa. Everything ties together. If we were in a larger room and I had a little more maneuverability, I could show you how some of the guards formed with holding a sword correspond to the four elements, and how you can use those to think about how to use those fighting postures. If you think in elemental terms and how energy level rises and falls, how the qualities of the element correspond to... you know what? Michael, hand me one of those for a second. I'm going to give a very quick example here. I'll have Rob walk through it. Yep. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, probably that's asking for trouble to do that. So I'm going to have Rob go through the four guards that we use from top to bottom. That is from fire to earth. This is the high guard. And then we have, and that can be held over the head or at the shoulder. Then we have a high thrusting guard. That's also used for defense because he's able to ward off an attack coming at him. So he is able to close off the line of attack. The word close is important. Then from air down to water, we have another point forward guard, which is able to close off a lower line of attack. And finally, we have a low guard where you're just waiting, looking seemingly vulnerable, even though you're actually prepared, corresponding to earth. Now, that guard and the highest guard are open guards. You are not closing off your opponent. You are prepared to deliver some sort of attack or perhaps respond in defense, but you have not closed the line. The point forward guards, water and air, are closing the line. So we have open guards and closed guards. Now I'm going to walk through those guards again, but I'm going to talk about those elemental qualities. Okay, so top. Fire is hot and dry. Air. Hot and wet. Cold and wet. Cold and dry. The dry guards are the open ones. They are places of stillness. The ones in the middle here that close the line are more fluid, and you can change even what side you hold those on, changing which lead you are, so they flow from one defense to another. So we have this idea of fluidity here in air and water and those two guards, and we have this sense of stillness, dryness, above and below. Here we see a system that works in physicality with something seemingly completely unrelated to mysticism. Now, I'm not going to tell you that the masters that designed these guards purposely said, I need a guard that looks like fire. It happened likely simply because this was their model of reality. This is how they thought about physicality. So this follows that framework. So is it an accident? Is it a coincidence? Yes and no. We have no proof saying from any one of these masters that wrote these books, yes, this corresponds to fire, but it follows the system. And if you think about the dynamic magically of the elements, it can inform, if you are so inclined, it can inform your fighting and make you actually a smarter fighter. Knowing this model of reality can make everything you do work better. Okay, thank you, Rob. So again, this is what kind of got me interested in, after having done magic sort of coming out of stuff I learned in the 70s and 80s, of taking a fresh look at things. Was actually, as I like to say, the grandmaster of the medieval fighting tradition that I work with, Johannes Lichtenauer, I like to say, I learned more about magic from Johannes Lichtenauer than I did from all the Llewellyn books I bought in the 80s. So this is has been a gold mine, not just for how I teach martial arts, medieval martial arts specifically, but how I think about the world in magical terms. And with that, with only a few minutes remaining, I'll turn the floor over to... hopefully, having given everybody some food for thought, I'll turn the floor over to any questions, comments.
I'd still like you to justify, other than through Isidore, why you cast the circle. Now, I'm trying to remember. It seems to me you started with air and then went to fire and then jumped down to earth.
No, we start with earth.
Oh, you do earth, water.
Yes, earth, water, air, fire, and then at the end, take it down, fire, go back down to energy level, fire.
So
air, water,
you earth. Cast the circle just as we would, except your Jussel is our Widdishins and your Widdishins is our Jussel.
Yeah, essentially, I think.
Yep, that's the only difference.
Well, we start in in the west with
right.
Earth.
Right.
Go to the north for water.
In the east with fire.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And whereas the Gardnerians just screw it all over.
Yeah, but they're not to blame, though. You know, they were following somebody else's mistake there. In fact, it's funny. I was just rereading, you know, trying to get past the dross and get at the useful things that are in magic and theory and practice. And I'm like, God, come on, Crowley. You were a smart guy. How did you not do the math on this?
I think I can explain. They followed the Egyptian system.
Yeah, maybe.
Which also works.
Yeah.
But it works with five, hence that they try to make it six, and therefore it goes green. And they forget completely, since they're such sun worshippers, that the horned one and the sun are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
And work at cross purposes and are in constant war.
Well, I think that's what happens. You know, what I think the Golden Dawn folks are suffering from a lot is they are inheritors of much of the Rose Cross and Hermetic material. But there's this Orientalism fad that's going through Victorian England. And of course, it's sort of, I don't know, it's no more accurate read of Egypt than Steve Martin's King Tut song was, you know?
Not really. It's just that they do the directions in the Egyptian order,
yeah.
And they leave out the dragon because the Western tradition thinks the dragon is evil,
right.
And therefore not to be considered.
I think they're just putting too many things in the stew. It's just
talk to a Welshman,
yeah.
And they'll tell you. Of course, the dragon has to be there.
Yeah.
Dragons are good.
Yeah. Well, our Sir Carl certainly thinks so. It's his heroic charge. You'll get no argument from him.
So, Mockingbird, you said in your rituals you start with fire and you bring the energy level down when you begin, and then bring it back up at the end?
That isn't the intent, but that is indeed the effect, and I see the advantage of your system for exactly that reason. I guess the idea is you start by charging the altar with fire, and then, yes, you're bringing the energy down before you can call the sacred powers. But there is, if I can quote the devil, which is always a good thing to do, when Mephistopheles is asked by Faust, how do I get to the land of the mothers? Do I go up or do I go down? Mephistopheles says, it doesn't matter. And Starhawk learned the same thing in her first book, The Spiral Dance. She called that realm that you try to get to when you get to the three, the higher self. And then when she wrote Dreaming in the Dark, she said, oops, what an idiot. It's the deeper self. Well, Mephistopheles would say, higher self, deeper self, Katzer Schmatzer.
Yeah,
it's the same thing. But if you think of it as the deeper self, then you're likely to do fire, air, water, earth. And if you think of it as the higher self, you're likely to do earth, water, air, fire.
Well, and there's another way to look at it too, which is if you are starting with fire, instead of simply it being, you know, invocation or evocation, depending on your point of view, you can also look at it as we're asking those powers to emanate down through to us.
Yes.
Here we are, we're emanating them down through. So I can see how that, you know, makes perfect sense. It really just depends on what angle you look at it from.
Yeah.
But the point is what we ended up with in the New Age system, if you will. I'm not going to, again, it's too easy to throw rocks at the Gardnerians. There's a lot of blame to go around. But the problem is we end up with a system there that's neither fish nor fowl.
Right.
It's neither correctly evocative nor is it emanating properly either. It does a loop.
So one way you're asking them to walk to you, and the other way you're walking to them.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
I like that.
Thinking now, like I've always thought of casting a circle in the same kind of way all my life, and my family, my covenant. And I realize it really doesn't make, like, what you're saying makes seems to make more sense. Just like the way you're actively thinking about the energies you're calling in, whatever. And I'm like, why have we always started in the west and gone Widdershins around back to north?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even that's just like that doesn't make a lot of sense. So.
Well, in some of the Christian magic traditions, we'll call it neo-Christianity, I guess, but you'll actually see some of the elemental stuff done in a crosswise pattern rather than in a circle.
The Finns always do the east, which for them is, I'll probably get this wrong, air. The west, which is water. The south, which is fire. And the northwest, which is earth. They never invoke the north because
they've got enough of that to go around. Yeah.
Yeah. Not only that, the Sami live in the north, and the Sami emanate magic, and even the Finns and even the Swedes and the Norwegians associate, according to Jane, the north with the position from which magic comes. And if the Sami are your enemy,
mm-hmm.
you don't want to invoke them.
No.
Right.
No. Yeah. That's taking your magic very personal indeed.
It sounds so funny. You know, you always hear east, west, south, northwest, and it seems bent.
Yeah. Well, no human model of reality is entirely consistent across every culture. You're going to find, you'll find local variations, and sometimes you have to dig very deep to understand why those variations are there. And that's really, I'd never heard that before. That's fantastic. I love that.
Of course, the idea of four elements is really more of a Hellenic Egyptian thing, more of something from the classical world. It's not outside of that. It's not really applicable.
Well, it's not. It's not a concept that you find in Chinese magic, for instance,
or five. Elements.
Five, yeah.
Right, but
yeah.
Native Americans often use four as mm-hmm. a sacred number. I mean, just look at any Diné story. Talking God shouts to the people. And they mill around and they don't pay any attention. He draws near. Talking God shouts to the people. They mill around and they pay no attention. And he draws near. Talking God shouts to the people. They mill around and they pay no attention. And now he's just upon them. Talking God shouts to the people. Everybody is quiet. If it isn't done four times, it doesn't count. There are other cultures where it has to be done three times. But, you know, pays your money, you takes your choice.
Yeah, no, I should have drawn that distinction, Michael, early on, that I'm discussing the West.
Right.
That, you know, other parts of the world have different ways of looking at this.
However, the Chinese, as remote as their system is supposed to be, you still have Jupiter with wood,
mm-hmm.
Then fire with Mars, and then Earth with Saturn. Then metal with Venus, and then water with Mercury. And you say, what happened to the sun and the moon? They are considered to be yin and yang, and they're aspects of all of the other five planets.
Right.
I just saw something. Go on.
No, go ahead.
Okay. You said that when the God was talking to the people, yeah. he had to talk four times.
Yes.
If you're talking to the God, like, say, like in a Norse invocation,
yeah.
you would call them three times. One is a god talking to the people, so you call it the physical. And one is the people calling to the god, so they're using three. They're each using the numbers of
the god.
Side, of, yeah. the,
makes a great deal of sense.
You know, all these, every system has, when you know you learn enough about it, it's its internal consistency that makes it work. It, that within that set of perspectives, everything makes sense. My criticism against the way we've seen elemental work done in the last 20, 30 years is it violates the internal consistency.
Yeah.
It violates, you know, we are inheriting a lot of this, the elements of the old traditions, but that's a big garbling, and it really is a major disconnect. And so, as I said, that was a huge revelation for me. It was it was a big deal selling it to a lot of our order's members at the time. Most of the dissenters actually, for other reasons, are actually not with us anymore. But this was perhaps a warning sign that that was going to happen. Was how violent the pushback was. I'm like, you know, but this is what I was taught. I'm like, yeah, but you were taught something that was made up in 1955. You know, it's just not that magical inherently, you know.
Do you know the Vedic system?
No, I don't. Well, tiny smatterings.
Okay, there's 8 sacred directions.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't correspond to all the days of the week you might think, but let me do it quickly and then you'll get it. In the east is Indra, ruler of the gods, their Zeus figure. In the southeast is Agni, fire. Curious. That's usually where the goddess lives, but the Vedics are different. In the south is Yama, the death god, whose element I suppose is air, but they don't seem to have one. In the southwest is Surya, the sun. In the west is Varuna, the god of knots and of sailors and water. And in the northwest is Vayu, the wind, and who eventually develops into Rudra and Shiva, and so becomes the dragon. And in the north is Kuvera, the earth god. And in the northeast is Soma. Soma is no god at all. He's what the gods eat.
Isn't that a hallucinogenic plant?
Yes. But they had an eighth direction, so they had to put something in it. And they knew they couldn't put a major god there because that would screw things up.
So the northeast is the mess hall.
Yeah, well, and look at Stonehenge. The northeast is open. That's the way you get in.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and when you look at the way the 8 sabbats line up, Yule is in the north, Imbolc in the northwest, Ostar in the west, Altana for the sun, of course, in the southwest, Letha in the south, Manasa in the southeast, Mabon in the east, and Samhain is in the northeast because it's dedicated to all the gods. And it's the way into the year.
Mm-hmm.
It's the open space.
Yeah.
Now, let the gardenerians try to cope with that.
That is a topic for another day. All right.
You wouldn't have any problem with it, but they would.
Yeah, yeah.
You change around the directions, but who cares?
It's the order. It's the order of operation. That's actually the most important thing.
Yeah.
All right, I think with that, I will close and thank everybody for their time and attention. I was pleased to do this as a little bit more free-form discourse type of thing rather than just prattling on just me for an hour, as usual. So I hope everybody enjoyed the format. Certainly I did. So thanks very much for attending.
And what tradition did the job? You know, it's...
Now I just need to figure out how to turn this off.
I feel like there's been some ordinary influences of
but not if you start in the west.
Okay.
And go just Wittgenstein, because the Gardnerians are allergic.
I just leave it be and have them more value.
Okay.
I was just supposed to have everything there, and she was very strongly influenced by the Celtic. There's kind of a lot of duality going on with the god and goddess. But I've been very open and interested to learning more. So I've been coming to these workshops. I'm also still figuring out my own things. So.
Where are you from?
I'm from northern Vermont.
Okay.
Oh, what?
So.
Let me give you our card.
Here, I'll just hand that down to this. Northeast Kingdom or Burlington?
Northeast Kingdom.
Uh-huh.
Are you here with
the
people of the horse?
My daughter does a trip this year. Starting in January, with a ski up the west side of Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And stopping Northeast Kingdom with canoes. This is for a school called Proca. It's in Marlboro, New Hampshire. But it's all, well, it's mostly all in Vermont. Mm-hmm. Until they get back to New Hampshire. Mm-hmm.
So what has been going on with the Knights?
Well, just this and that, doing training, having tournaments, having gatherers.
You spoke with people who have left. Is that,
oh, that's years ago. That's very, very old news. Yeah,
that's what, 4 or 5 years ago now.
Yeah, it's the beginning of 2007.
Yeah, that's okay. Beginning of 2007. So that's
That's ancient.
No, stuff's been pretty smooth sailing.
Robert hasn't given you any trouble.
No, not too much. Not too much. He's been relatively well behaved, all things considered.
That's right.
Yeah, I was hoping we would be able to drag Chris Valley up here this time, but he's all hell broke loose with his work, and he totaled his car. He's had like the string of half a dozen bad things go wrong.
He just got married.
He just got married. As soon as he came back from the honeymoon, things started going wrong. Yeah.
I don't. I go to Hampshire, but they had some extra tickets, so I was registered under them, I guess.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to check in and see if any of these moved. I do have books and videos for sale today if folks are looking. But.